I will mark my territory as the journalist in the KITP crowd by not using PowerPoint for one. And I don't think there isn't a single equation in anything I'm going to talk about. But if anybody would like to try and produce one out of it, I would love to see what you can do. So my name is Jacob Berkowitz, and I'm from Ottawa, Canada, and here until the middle of December as the journalist in residence at KITP. And I really see today as, I'm really happy to be speaking and have the chance to, for me, what I really feel is open a dialogue about some of the broader issues that I've been thinking about the interaction between science and journalism, and how we can make those smoother and more enjoyable for everyone. And also, I think, as you'll see from the presentation, my bigger aim is really that I think we're in the midst of telling a really incredible number of amazing new stories about who we are, where we fit in the universe, what the universe is, and that interaction between journalists and scientists is one of those first steps of bringing science into the larger culture. So although I'm the journalist in residence, I'm not going to talk today about most of the traditional things that we think about in journalism and science and that interaction. So press releases, how to develop a good quote, the vagaries of the 24-hour news cycle. But I'd be glad to do that individually with anyone. And if anybody wants to sit down and, I was thinking of something like a power hour. If you want to sit down with me and talk about the science you're doing for an hour or half an hour, I'd be glad then to go away and put that into the context of a story. How would I popularize your work, to bring it outside of the lab or the observatory or your blackboard? So I'd be glad to do that with anybody. It would be a treat. But I'm going to take this opportunity to step back and, we're at a theoretical institute here. I'm going to kind of maybe take a bigger kind of theoretical perspective on all of this. And partly that's from my own experience. I started 20 years ago as a high school teacher teaching science and English, and after that I worked at a natural history museum as an educator, so talking to folks about the dinosaurs that were there was the Canadian Museum of Nature in Ottawa, so a big natural history museum. I went on to get into public affairs there, and then for the last decade I've been a freelance journalist and an author. So I've written a series of kids' books, one about copper lights or fossil poop, and which is my claim to fame. I'm glad I have a second book coming out, which can, although copper lights, it turns out, are the best source of ancient DNA. And it's actually an incredible story of how something that was poo-pooed 40 years ago has ended up becoming an incredible source of information. Actually, you might have seen in the paper, I think it was about 2 months ago, actually the earliest evidence of human presence in North America is coprolite that was found in a cave in Oregon. And it's 14,000 years old. So if anybody wants to talk about the details of that stuff, I'd be glad to as well. But, really writing for the past 10 years. So what I'm going to talk about in terms of integrating science and journalism and bringing the story of science into the larger culture really comes out of my experience as the broad term as a science communicator, as someone who's worked for, two decades with kids to adults and newspapers in classrooms, and getting the perspective of how do people really integrate scientific information into their lives. Often folks who have zero background in what you're initially telling them. So in terms of this crossing the bridge between the two cultures, and what I mean by two cultures, I'd like to just start with an anecdote. And for me, one of the seminal moments in my thinking about this came in 2005. I was in Washington, D.C. for an astrobiology conference. And astrobiology is one of those fascinating fields that has emerged really in the last 15 years with the discovery of the first exoplanet, the first planet around another star, 1995. And it's a field that's an amalgam of biology, astrophysics, astronomy, earth sciences, trying to understand the evolution of life on Earth, but also the evolution of life in a cosmic context. So the conference in Washington in 2006, you know, there was this real sense with the discovery of so many exoplanets. There, I think, I don't know, like in the high 200s now, and the awareness that water is ubiquitous in the universe, and that there are probably billions of exoplanets just in the Milky Way, and that there are probably other terrestrial exoplanets in the so-called Goldilocks zone, where it's warm enough for there to be liquid water around another star, that probably the universe is alive, and that the Earth isn't a unique example of life. It isn't some aberration, that we are the end result of a cosmic process that's happening all over. So there's a lot of buzz in this room, okay? And there's a sense that, you know, folks are on the edge of making one of the, you know, the greatest discoveries in science. Even though the other life forms that we discover might, you know, will probably be bacterial, okay? Still completely, it's kind of, I see it as the third story of the Copernican revolution. You know, we're not the center of the universe. We're not evolved separately from other animals, and we're not the only life in the universe. So there's an enormous excitement in this room. But that morning, I had walked to the conference at the Ronald Reagan Conference Center in downtown Washington, and passed by the White House. And I thought at some moment there, here I am, okay, in the most powerful scientific nation that's ever existed on Earth, with a group of people who are on the verge of having a sense of discovering cosmic evolution. And there's a president of this country, three blocks away, who doesn't believe that life on Earth evolved through a biological process. And I thought, that is amazing. How can that be? So I think that President Bush, you know, is far from being alone in his views. I mean, and we know that from, you know, general surveys, somewhere between a quarter and a half of Americans believe that dinosaurs and humans coexisted, or at least, I mean, towards the higher half, that evolution is only one possible answer, that the theory is just one idea, and that there are other ways of explaining this, usually based on kind of creationist or an intelligent design mode. And that's on the 150th anniversary next year of Asa Darwin's Origin of the Species. So I think that frustration, we tend to dismiss or mock those, you know, these other attitudes from a scientific perspective. And what I'd like to do today is just stop and breathe and take a step back and say, wow, this is really a mystery. How can this be that with all of the information of the last 150 years supporting evolution and other, you know, I mean, this extends now to issues around climate change and other scientific facts. How can such a large part, subculture of the population, not agree with the scientific evidence? So I guess the question is then, what's the problem? Why isn't this information getting through? And usually, if you read in the last couple of months, there have been several major features and editorials in Science and Nature about the upcoming American election and the importance of science in the election. And in these discussions, what this issue generally comes down to is an education problem. They generally talk about a problem, the modern language for it is science literacy or science illiteracy. And the assumption here is that these people who don't have the scientific perspective, they lack the scientific facts. Okay? So if you give them more facts, they will change their perspective and they will understand. Okay? Now, I think it's a fundamental kind of misunderstanding of the problem, because right behind the White House is the Smithsonian Institute, right? Which is full of one of the world's greatest collections of fossils. So if you want to go and see the evidence, you don't have to go very far to see an incredible selection of evidence. So I think that the problem here is that facts don't necessarily change people's perspective. And I think the bigger question here is, or the bigger issue, is that in many cases, the scientific facts are rejected by an audience, and that there's a general alienation from a scientific way of thinking about the world. And that's kind of the larger issue I'd like to deal with here today in talking about bridging two cultures, because I think that's really at the core of the challenge. Because it doesn't matter how many new facts. As a high school teacher, I had kids who were from a fundamentalist church, and it was a challenging experience. I thought I was going to teach, this is my first year of teaching 20 years ago, I thought I was going to, really give them the facts. And I ended up being videotaped as an example of kind of the scientific mindset, So it was completely turned around on me, facts or not. So I guess when we talk about, when I talk about science and journalism, I see it as the first our relationship as really the first step of how do we then integrate scientific information, not just the facts and more than the facts, into the larger culture. And so I think when we talk about that, the scientific journalism relationship is a microcosm of a much bigger process that's going on, that's kind of represented by our relationship. So I'd like to take a bit of to think about that. I'd like to, two cultures, to take a historical perspective. And next year is the 50th anniversary of a famous lecture that was given at Cambridge by C.P. Snow. I think it's Charles Percy Snow. And it was a lecture that, at least in academic and kind of intellectual circles, has defined the discussion about the difference between scientific and all other cultures in societies. So I just want to touch a little bit about what Snow said about this relationship between two cultures. So he was an interesting guy. He was, I think, born in like 1905. He had gone to Cambridge as a student studying physics, went to lectures with Bohr and Einstein and Frank. He had really been there with the heavy hitters of the quantum revolution and the beginning of the 20th century. But he ended up becoming a novelist. And so he bridged the cultures between kind of literary culture and scientific culture at Cambridge in the middle of the century and during the war. And he was also, many of his novels are focused around, he was kind of an anthropologist of academics. He was really interested in the academic process. I mean, not just the tempest in a teapot and departmental politics, but in the mixture of the rational mind and the emotional mind, and how that played out in universities. And he observed something that he found very discomforting, and that was the basis of this famous lecture he gave in 1959. And he said that he had a lot of friends who were scientists, a lot of friends who were literary intellectuals, philosophers, other novelists, and he said that the process of moving from one group to another was like moving between cultures. And this is what he said. He said, "I felt I was moving among two groups or cultures, comparable in intelligence, identical in race, not grossly different in social origin, earning about the same incomes, who had almost ceased to communicate at all, who in intellectual, moral, and psychological climate had so little in common that instead of going from Burlington House to South Kensington to Chelsea," I'm sure there's someone who understands what he's talking about here, the Brits, okay, "one might have crossed an ocean." Now, you might say, so what, right? Okay, it's, you know, these academics, he talked about being at the head table at Cambridge, and, you know, the literary folks couldn't talk to the physics or the emerging, you know, the new molecular biologists, you know, Watson and Crick had been there in 53, and, you know, and he said, no one talked to the mathematicians, but, you know, he said these folks were separated by walls of language and value and culture, but he saw something that was particularly troubling about this at a time when science had essentially, in many ways, won the war. I mean, there's that expression, I think radar won the war and the atomic bomb ended it. You know, that algorithms and code breaking had been so important in winning the war. And now, the hydrogen bomb had been developed. Molecular biology was just beginning with the discovery of the helical structure of DNA, that there was this enormous emergence of science as an important social and cultural power, and yet, okay, the attitude towards it among this literary group, I'll tell you how he describes it here. He says, "A good many times I have been present at gatherings of people who, by the standards of traditional culture, are thought highly educated and who have with considerable gusto been expressing their incredulity at the illiteracy of scientists. Once or twice I've been provoked and have asked the company how many of them could describe the second law of thermodynamics. The response was cold and it was also negative. Yet I was asking something which is about the scientific equivalent of, have you read any Shakespeare plays? So the great edifice of modern physics goes up, and the majority of the cleverest people in the Western world have about as much insight into it as their Neolithic ancestors would have had." So he termed, you know, his lecture the two cultures, and, you know, as I said, what he posited as the problem was, how were the decision makers at 10 Downing Street in the British context, most of whom are Oxford and Cambridge literary grads, I mean, from that kind of arts and science, what we now call it, you know, social sciences background, how are they able to make informed decisions about major policy issues when they have not only little understanding, but disdain, often, for science? And, you know, today we call it, I even have to read it because it's hard to get off the tongue, you know, evidence-based decision-making, and in a democratic knowledge-based society. When you read the journal articles about this kind of stuff today, that's how we talk about it. But how do politicians know how to make decisions about the world, global climate change, if they, it's not so much they, you know, they don't understand the facts, but they really don't see the value of science in the larger society. So, you know, Snow realized, and the response to his lecture, which ended up in this book form, and there was quite a lot of discussion about it at the time, His response to that was, we need to get more facts into people's heads. Basically, we need to improve the British education system. And I think that was definitely, you know, part of the issue. Students can't, you know, shouldn't be graduating from high school without a fundamental understanding of, you know, scientific basics. But I think, as you know, as I've said already, I think it's more than the facts. But for the past 50 years, people have been talking about this relationship between two cultures, really in the terms that Snow set out. So, where are we 50 years later? So there's obviously in academia still much. If you want to focus on that, I think there's lots of both mudslinging cooperation. I mean, the 1990s and the early 2000s, like here in the United States, and I'm not sure about, you know, in Australia and Europe and elsewhere. But, you know, the science wars, this, you know, battles between scientists in academia and social scientists who were beginning to, you know, the history of science, the sociology of science. I mean, there's this famous case of the Sokol affair. I think it's, is it Alan Sokol? At Columbia?
NYU.
You know, who wrote this mock cultural studies article that was complete gibberish, 20 pages. You know, it's quite phenomenal to read. You know, and then after it was published in the journal, said, aha, you know, got you. You know, you guys have no idea about, you know, this is just all gobbledygook, this cultural studies of science stuff, and you don't know, you know, what you're talking about, and you can't see the difference between reality and something that's made up. But what I think is really interesting and more pertinent for today is that the two-culture analogy has moved out of academia. And what it is today, 50 years after Snow, I think those two cultures are represented by science and journalism. And I'll tell you why. I think that the technological changes of the past 50 years in terms of the enormous rise in mass media, particularly television and then the internet, but also, you know, just the widespread, you know, ability to publish newspapers wherever, whenever, radio, I mean, that we live in such a media-embedded culture, that has really, the media and journalists have become the beachhead for that literary culture that Snow saw at, you know, in Cambridge in the writers. And I guess I call it, in a broader sense, the literary culture is story culture. It's people like me for whom meaning in the world is either gathered or expressed through a narrative, through a story. That's the way I see the world. And that'll see towards the end here when I talk about what are the details of these two cultures, that becomes a very important point. Now, journalists becoming the beachhead of this other culture has made it a big difference, because Snow said the problem back in 59 was that the literary culture and the scientific culture didn't have to talk. If these folks in Cambridge, you know, if the dons or the professors wanted to walk past one another in the hall without even nodding, that was just fine. They didn't have to talk. Okay? Today, we often have to talk. In fact, okay, I would say we exist in one of the most choreographed dances of any journalism. I mean, you talk to a lot of journalists, science journalists, we feel like kind of, you know, bulls with a ring through our nose, right? The embargoed paper comes out, and we all kind of run after it, right? And, you know, get a quote, that it's very choreographed. And just to see the change in that relationship in the last, you know, 50 years, when Watson and Crick published their paper on the helical structure of DNA in Nature, it was 3 weeks before there was a two-paragraph article in the New York Times. 3 weeks, right? I mean, you know, like today when the Human Genome Project was completed, I mean, it was this huge, you know, international event with the presidents and prime ministers and, You know, the relationship has changed, you know, enormously in 50 years. So, you know, it's the reason that I'm here is because we're encouraged to talk to one another. These two cultures are encouraged to get together. So, what's changed then? You know, if we're now, Snow predicted, or he said, you know, the problem was these people didn't talk to one another. He said, but if they did, if you have, like, you know, the shore and the ocean where it's a rich ecological zone, if you had these two groups talking to one another, then something special can happen. So, now we are talking to one another. So what? How would people describe these two cultures today? Anyone read the Bad Science column in The Guardian? Anybody follow that at all? A guy named Ben Goldacre, if you ever pick up The Guardian or go online and read he's one of the most kind of trenchant British journalists who writes about, or commentators who writes about the relationship between science and journalism. So think about what Snow said about the two cultures, and here's a quote from his Guardian, a Guardian article of his from 2005. Writes Goldacre, reflects a humanities graduate's parody of science. This misrepresentation of science is a direct descendant of the reaction in the Romantic movement against the birth of science and empiricism more than 200 years ago. It's exactly the same paranoid fantasy as Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, only not as well written. We may say descendant, but of course the humanities haven't really moved forward at all, except to invent cultural relativism, which exists largely as a poo-poo reaction against science. And humanities graduates in the media, who suspect themselves to be intellectuals, desperately need to reinforce the idea that science is nonsense, because they've denied themselves access to the most significant developments in the history of Western thought for 200 years. And deeply and secretly, deep down, they're angry with themselves over that. So that doesn't sound that much different than C.P. Snow saying, you know, the great edifice of physics goes up and, you know, these folks have no, the literary intellectuals have no idea about it. But that in many ways is characteristic of a discussion the public discussion at least, about the relationship between science and journalism. And the key thing is that the way it's often discussed, and this is internationally, whether it's in Canada, in Europe, in the States here, in India, I've seen many references to it, is that there's a problem, that there's a problem. And that's really some, you know, that it's still at the stage that C.P. Snow described of, you know, not only two cultures, but two solitudes, that don't understand one another. And I think that's reflected in the 1997 report that was produced here in the States. A NASA scientist and a veteran television journalist got together and wrote a report about science and journalism. And what they called it was Worlds Apart: How the Distance Between Science and Journalism Threatens America's Future. So it was really C.P. Snow all over again 40 years later with the same things. It was reflecting on, at the time, he was reflecting on, they were reflecting on the fact that in the mid-90s, for the first time since the Second World War, science funding in the United States and in many other countries was being challenged, was being cut. You know, it was the end of the Cold War. There was no longer that military drive for scientific funding. And for the first time, scientists and scientific communities needed to defend and explain what they were doing, why they should get the money that was being budgeted for them. And so at that time, I'll read you what they wrote. They said, almost every American newspaper has an astrology column. Very few have a weekly science column. Today, half the American public doesn't know that it takes a year for the Earth to rotate around the sun. Now, that's a favorite of this National Science Foundation Public Understanding of Science survey that's done every couple of years. And so, meanwhile, within two short generations, 50% of U.S. citizens will depend on science and technology for their living. And of course, so many of the decisions we make, either, you know, well, those of you who can vote here in the States, or, you know, in our own countries or in our own lives, you know, are based around the new challenges that science and technology present to us. You know, reading the paper the other day that there are now, how many was it, 500,000 frozen embryos in the United States, you know, of couple who are involved in using reproductive technologies who already have children, and now there are these other embryos. Wait, I mean, it's this huge ethical and, you know, scientific issue that's emerged out of new technology and new science. So we're continually faced with these decisions. But they say something must change, and soon. Both science and journalism tend to attract practitioners who are above average in intelligence and education. I guess you can see it was a scientist and a journalist who were writing the article. And both groups are highly motivated and free thinking. So why the gulf in their communication? And that's what I'd like to talk about now. So why even 50 years after, I mean, are there some folks who feel, you know, that really there's this enormous divide between science and the next conduit, journalism, into the popular culture? And I think that, in fact, something very positive is afoot. I don't think it's as dire as the quotes that that I've read here. In the presentations I'm going to give in the next, this is the first of four in the next month, I'll talk about that. But something happened in the 1980s in response to the cutbacks, and in response also to an enormous boom in science journalism in around the world. Certainly in Canada, we had something called the Discovery Channel, which I'm not sure how many of you in your countries have a dedicated cable science channel, but that was really something that came out in the In the 80s, the New York Times science section started in, I think, 79. There was a real boom. And then in response to the cutbacks, after the initial shock, and I was at the Canadian Museum of Nature at the time, and it was incredible to be in an institution that since, like, you know, 1880 had a single scientific tradition. There'd been no question of cutbacks. And now the country's only Lichen taxonomist was being cut. I mean, that position was being cut. The psychic blow, you know, was enormous. I mean, this was, you know, people were doing science for science's sake, right? This and having to suddenly defend what they were doing was an enormous change. But out of that, pain, came the realization, well, maybe we need to do scientific PR. And it was, you know, public relations, and it was something that had been anathema. Is that the word? Anathema. I shouldn't use that word. It was bad. You know, it's bad to be a popularizer before that. In French, I like the word in French for popularizing is vulgariser, and I think it captures how a lot of scientists feel about it. You're vulgarizing it, something, you know, outside of what a decent scientist does. And what was interesting here is the process that people went through and are going through now in thinking about, okay, how do we reach out and share the scientific stories that we're discovering? How do we do this? And at first glance, okay, the first thing is, well, you got to dumb it down. Okay, we'll dumb it down. We'll simplify it. Okay, so scientists and journalists would often be brought together into training sessions, and something interesting emerged. And what appeared, okay, was that what scientists often thought was the least important part of what they needed to do turned out to be the most important. And it had nothing to do with the facts of the science. And I'll give you a couple of examples. I don't know if from Australia, you know these folks at an organization called eConnect. Have you ever come across them? No? Or any other? No? Anyway, a woman named Jenny Metcalf and Tass Gasconi, and they've been involved in science communication, again, for 20 years and run workshops with hundreds of scientists in terms of helping them popularize their work. So they give everyone a questionnaire when they come into the workshop, and it has about 15 questions. And the participants in the workshops get to choose the things they're most interested and least interested in learning about journalism. And the number one thing that scientists are interested in these ones is, the most popular response year after year is, quote, tailoring a scientific message to suit the media without compromising the quality of the message. So really getting the facts across. And what they're least interested in is understanding the pressures and constraints under which journalists work. I didn't know it was that funny, but that's good. Okay? And this actually turns out to be a universal, well, I shouldn't say universal, we're still here at Terrestrial, but it's a general attitude. There's a program in the States, one of the most interesting programs I've seen in the States of this type, bringing journalists and scientists together and providing kind of that cross-cultural mix, is one called the Aldo Leopold Leadership Program. And it plays on the idea of the civic scientist. So this is the idea that if you're going to have to do the congressional report or even have to write your public summary on the on an NSF grant, that you need these basic public communication skills to be able to cross this cultural divide. And so what they developed a program that was, I think, a couple of weeks long, and ran into the same issue that these folks in Australia had. And I'd just like to tell you that the program's founder is a fellow named Barry Gold, and I'd like to read what he said in an article he wrote reflecting on the process of developing this program. He said, in the first year, we skipped the cultural issue and found we were miscommunicating. You have to provide the training in the context of explaining the different cultures represented by policymakers, the media, and scientists. So we had to step back and spend a lot of time on what the different cultures are and why people in those different cultures perceive the same information differently. And I really appreciate, part of me feels badly in leaving the kind of the core of the differences until the end, but I really felt that in terms of making the case for why the cultural differences are significant and core to our working relationship, and why they can really be the bug in the ointment that can wreck it. It's one of these kind of nebulous things that if you don't make the case for it, it's hard to kind of get your hand around. What is culture? It's not, you can't put it into an equation. It's not concrete. But what I found is that for many of these cultural things, I call it starting from the end. What you think is least important is actually the most important to communicating what you want to do across cultures. And I'll just give you one example I'm going to talk about another time. I'm a judge for a DOE-sponsored, Department of Energy-sponsored essay writing contest for students. And so these are all folks, these are students who are graduates in a computational sciences graduate fellowship program. So I was reading one of these essays, and it was interesting. The fellow was at Los Alamos, and he was doing modeling related to weapons simulations, you know, which is so central to computational science. And at the end of it, the last paragraph, the second last sentence, he said, I am the third generation in my family to work at Los Alamos doing this work. And I'm like, you mean your grandfather worked with Oppenheimer, right, building the bomb, and your father, who knows who he worked with? So at the end, So starting at the end, this person had left what, you know, for anybody who's reading a story, is the hook of the story, the meat of the story, about his personal story, was in the last sentence, because he didn't think it was important at all, because he was talking about facts. So now I'd just like to end off, I'll take the last couple of minutes before we go for coffee, and talk about, okay, so how do we think about these bridging these cultures? And I want to do two little icebergs here. And here's the... I have a friend who's a cross-cultural trainer in Ottawa, and he works with a lot of soldiers, Canadian soldiers who are going to Afghanistan, or Canada has a contingent of military police who go to Haiti, and you know, often in a peacekeeping role in you know, in Bosnia, but in this case in a combat role in Afghanistan. And what he tells them is, when you experience cross-cultural shock or cross-cultural interaction, what creates culture shock, and I got to be honest, I experienced it in my first week, and I'm still kind of coming out of it, coming here, because it is very different. You know, I work completely on my own in my little office, and I'm thinking in stories all the time, and I really couldn't understand a lot that was going on the first week in conversations, and that's because 90% of what's going on in a culture is below the waterline. Okay, up here. We see, you know, the public, let's see here. You know, these are things like, it would be easier, I was trying to look, I mean, imagine in your mind, I'm thinking of, what's her name, the hotel heiress, Paris Hilton. I saw her once in a picture with, you know, or some, just a Hollywood starlet or star, you know, with like Maasai warriors in Kenya. You know, then you can look and you go, yeah, culturally they're obviously really different. But the things we see at the top, we see clothes, you know, we see public behavior, you know, and we see, what else do we see? We hear, you know, language. So those are the things that we see. And between scientists and journalists, we look at one another and we go, clothes, public behavior, language. Well, we really, I mean, one of the things interesting about science is we really don't see public behavior in science. It's not like sports, right? You can watch a sports game, and whether you know, read the analysis or not, you can watch it for yourself. You can watch politics. With science, it's really only through the telling of the stories that we begin to see there's not a lot of public behavior, and the language in public isn't that different, but it's what's happening below here, okay, that really makes the big difference. So that's where we talk about the beliefs. These are things that we can't see what someone's, you know, beliefs are. They're, what else here? We have their value, you know, values. What else? You know, history, the social structure. Those are the subtle elements, okay? That, I mean, one of the equivalents is, you know, the cross-cultural handshake. I mean, if we were to like do, you know, handshakes in different cultures, what's considered a polite amount of time to maintain it? Those are relatively nebulous things that you can get into kind of situations where, you know, you've created a major faux pas, not understanding at all what you've done. Now, I think part of the challenge with scientists and journalists is that culturally, in a lot of ways, well, as Snow said, we're coming from the same kind of demographic mix, right? We can all have the same, you know, the same parents, basically. But there are also an enormous number of cultural similarities before I get to the differences. Both highly competitive fields that are by necessity cooperative, right? I both feel that we're all essentially, I mean, when I'm excited about a story, it's because I feel I'm uncovering the truth. I'm getting, you know, I'm revealing the world to myself and to my readers, which I would think that that's kind of what science, you know, is as well. You live by publish or perish, right? So there are many similarities, but okay, I would say there are three fundamental cultural differences that are at the core of 99% of the problems. And this is why I think that if you can begin to understand, you know, and kind of bridge these cultural differences, the press release, the quote, all of the other things fall into place. Because those aren't difficult to do. I mean, you know, you can almost buy those. But if you don't have this kind of underlying cultural sense, it's very difficult. So if we say scientists here, journalists, and I'm going to generalize, and I think that I'm just hoping to, you know, I think that when we just look at the culture up here, this 10%, that's where we get the stereotype. That's where we get the image of, how many of you know Beaker from the Muppets? You know, the scientist in the white lab coat is always blowing himself up. We have stereotypes when we're only seeing this. And we also exist, I think, in fear when we're not willing to kind of get below the water and really get to know another culture. Then we kind of keep them at arm's length. They're different than us. Can't deal with those people. Okay. Here, I think, are some of the things that make us that make the conversations challenging, and that if we both understand, then we can go, okay, I think this is what's kind of tripping us up here. Scientists. When I think about stories, like those ones in that workshop in Australia, they think facts. I got to get facts in there. It's all about the facts. Okay? For journalists, it's all about the story. There's a reason that newspaper articles aren't written just as a textbook. We could just put the facts in. You know, there's a reason it's not done like that. And part of what's, I'd say, a subcategory here is that quantitative, especially here, this just blew me away my first week here, the extent to which it's quantitative, right? I mean, that might just seem to you like, how could anybody be surprised at that? That's what we do, right? But the extent of it, because I've never actually just spent like a long time in a you know, theoretical physics culture. I knew it from talking to people and reading the articles, but to live it has been really amazing. Because when I think story, quantitative is important, right? But I had the same problem when I taught high school. It's like kids would laugh at me. Okay. Qualitative, thank you. Should write this down before. Qualitative. And I'm the writer. What a joke. So, you know, I'm not thinking about a story without thinking about describing what the person looks like, what the environment is like, what the, you know, the feelings of the place. You know, it's going to get with, you know, they call in journalism spike. The editor's going to be like, what is this? This isn't a story. Okay, this is just a bunch of facts. You haven't contextualized into a story. And here, I mean, with the quantitative precision, right? I mean, you're talking particular details that, I mean, you know, the way that journalism is often described is that the article is the first draft of history. And that first draft is, we know, is going to contain error. You try, you do your best that it doesn't have any errors, okay? But if it does, and most of you know, when you read an article on which you're an expert, you'll know that there's generally going to be a couple of errors. And I once had someone when I was working at this Museum of Nature call me. We'd had a wonderful article in the paper, big photo about a new fossil exhibit. And in it, the journalist had written that a fossil, you know, basically tried to describe a fossil, saying it was something that had been lithified, you know, turned into rock, unlike a leaf that just dropped off a tree. So the article comes out. I'm thinking, yeah, I did my job. Great, fantastic. get a call from the scientist, furious. Okay? The minute it falls off the tree, it's a fossil. Doesn't have to be lithified, right? I'm like, okay, precision, right? So he had missed all of this, the value, you know, the people reading it thinking like, wow, it's true, you know, there are all these amazing fossils, they tell the story of evolution. Fully focused on that. Okay, so this is like one, two, and I'll quickly do the others and we can have a little chat before coffee. Second one is language. Now, highly, for scientists, highly technical, very peer-to-peer oriented, and in a tense, certainly in the written tense, tends to be passive, as if, you know, passive in the sense that it's not done by anybody, it's a third person kind of, this just exists. It's not that quantum field theory needs us around, it exists, okay? Now, language for journalists, I mean, for me, writing a story, I have to realize there's something called the grade 8 rule. Your average reader is working at a grade 8 vocabulary. And that means often for language, that's not that could even be someone that has a PhD in a different discipline. But if you're using words that have no, you know, that are specific, so I love this. The geneticists here and the astrophysicists both talk about extinction, right? Extinction to the astrophysicists is a completely different concept, right, than it is to, you guys can talk amongst yourselves, you know, figure that one out, okay? But I have to use language. You think about it, you're reading a newspaper story, how many words do you have to hit before you go to the next story, right? One, two, like three, you're gone, right? It's like, I can read the comics, right? I don't need to read this stuff. Okay?
I can read for us anyhow.
Yeah, exactly. And the last one I'll say is, the role of the individual. And this one I find one of the most interesting. Because in journalism, okay, you are the hero. You have to be the hero of the story, okay? Because a story ultimately operates in a mythic context, okay? The Bible, the Iliad, every story that exists draws on all of the stories that came before it. Any good baseball story, what makes a good baseball story or a good sport, rugby story, or, you know, it's that the story, the game is put into the context of a larger mythic competition, right? Individuals who rise and fall, you know, that is the core. You are the hero, okay, of the story. Whether you like it or not, you have to be the hero, okay? A lot of scientists really don't like that, okay? Because it goes against a core part of the scientific culture, which is that I am not an important. Reality exists outside of me. Reality will be discovered whether I exist or not. Okay, it's an impersonal, I guess, to a certain extent. The language it's written in is third person, and that it's an objective thing. I am the observer. I am not a subjective part. I'm not playing a part in this story. I'm observing the story. So in the next 3 weeks, I'm going to talk specifically about each of those. But I think that at least if, you know, in your interaction with the journalist or our interaction, keeping these things in mind when the discomfort rises. You know, I think that's the clue. It's from your gut. You know, when you begin to go, ooh, what's like, you know, what are my peers going to think when they see this, you know, in the paper, right? They're going to think I'm a, you know, I said that, or, you know, that if you can kind of at least think back to the icebergs and what's going on, I think it, you know, might be helpful.
Our friends who are reading it are also thinking back to that.
That's the key thing. That is the key thing, or at least be able to describe to them, hey, you don't know about the cultural differences here. So I'm glad to talk over coffee, but if there are any particular questions now or comments, yeah.
So I think there's a another way of looking at this individual thing is that I've a couple of times been involved with talking to reporters about truly collaborative work. Stuff where if there hadn't been five of us working on it, it wouldn't have happened. And yet, in one case, and it was either the San Francisco Chronicle or the New York Times, it was a big news, they only wanted one name, one person to speak. And that just doesn't seem fair to me. I mean, what do you as a journalist think?
Can I just give one more example? Where I was on Quirks and Quarks, which is a Canadian radio program about science, which is really good. And I mentioned my collaborators' names, that, you know, this person did this piece of it and discovered these other things, whatever. And so that, but then mid-sentence, they edited out those people's names that I mentioned. So that it was just a continuous thing, right? So that it really did seem like it was just me, even though I told, I swear.
I totally agree, and it's like mea culpa because space, time, but it's true, it distorts, and I even know, like I'll be sitting there writing, and I know that by having like one individual as the hero, it creates better dramatic tension in the story. That's I can just feel it. I know, okay? But I know that's exactly. I know that's not telling the real story. And it's an effort to go, okay, because sometimes it plays both ways. I mean, a lot of articles now, a lot of press releases will come out, you know, the last paragraph is, and the collaborators were, you know.
They don't get picked up.
Well, you know, I mean, I think partly the PR people are pitching it as one person because they realize that that's, so I totally agree. It needs to be kind of a collaborative effort to keep saying, you know, and it's increasingly so. I mean, particle physics, astrophysics, I'm sure a lot of other fields, that it is more and more collaborative and that getting that story out is an important part of it.
But what you're saying is it just complicates it so much that you can't sell the story.
Well, it's like imagine in a sports context. You know, imagine that, you know, the quarterback, he passed to the receiver, 50-yard pass. They don't describe, you know, all the linesmen. You know, it was a team effort. Okay, but it would just become a very complex story. And I'm not saying it's not, you know, because there we saw it was everybody's effort. In science, we don't. So I agree. It's hard. It's an important story to tell. It takes that extra effort, even if they chop it out. I think just keep going.
Out of all of the interviews that I did, that was the best. It was probably the best one. So in actuality, the story came out the best, and they were really good at what they did. But as scientists, when I go back and talk to my colleagues about it, they don't understand because, you know, we have to face this pressure from our colleagues and everything else, which makes us not want to do things like the things that are better for the journalism, right? We don't want to say, well, I discovered this and I did this because it's not good for our community.
Oh, no, I'm not saying you should distort. I'm not saying you should say I did this rather than say we, you know, we. I think I'm thinking that, you know, hopefully, you know, I think that we're all on a big journey. I mean, it's been 500 years since, you know, Galileo, and we're still integrating that understanding of the world into our popular culture. 150 years since Darwin. This isn't going to be done in our generation. It's a, you know, multi-generational journey we're on as we discover new things about the world. So we just have to keep kind of plugging away at changing those perceptions. Because I think it's important that, you know, students who are coming up realize this is a collaborative enterprise.
How much of the effects that were just described from a functional point of view are due to the author, the journalist, and how much to the editor who chops up the story?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think I could give a
quantitative.
That's right. 10%. 10% is the editor. See, I tend to be. I have specialized as a science journalist. So, and I'm a freelancer, which means that I'm not going to send. I have to make sure my story is tight. If there are any errors in my story, and someone calls the paper, and you know, the scientist calls the paper and says, you know, Jake Berkowitz is full of crap. I didn't say that. They just say, we don't want any more of your stories. So, you know, editors, well, I think, you know, I think editors write headlines. Journalists, I mean, that's the key thing. Journalists don't write headlines. So the person who writes a story doesn't write the headline. That's often where misconceptions happen. I know that didn't give you your quantitative answer, but
For example, aren't newspaper articles often written so that you had more and more facts at the end that can then just be cut to make space, and so...
Yeah, exactly. So the inverted pyramid. But the fact is, if you were to start... So, you know, what's interesting is the newspaper article works in the reverse of the journal article. So the journal article starts off with background, process, methodology, comes to conclusions at the end. The journalist takes that, goes to the very end, what did you find? I mean, reads the abstract, basically. You know, what did you find? And then at the end it would give some of the background. Sorry? The collaborators would be at the end. So, your question was, okay, right, where you cut. If you, as the journalist, if I were to write a story and say, University of California, Santa Barbara, researcher so-and-so has discovered X along with colleagues Y, Z, T, and W, no editor in the world is going to let that pass. That's going to be gone, right? I mean, just as you experienced, they might move that to the end, but better that the journalist put it at the end, because generally if it gets cut, it ain't going back in.
So I guess this goes back to my to your comment about the story. And I have lots of stories that I'm really interested in. I want to know the origin of the elements. I want to know the history of the Milky Way. Mm. It's not people that I'm interested in. Well, I'm interested in her, sorry. Thank you, Heather. But I just, I just wonder, because to me, leading off with, the main fact that we discovered about the Milky Way or whatever, and you can put the scientists' names at the bottom as far as I'm concerned, but from my perspective, what I really want to know is, we discovered this huge satellite has been accreted onto the Milky Way, and that's the interesting fact.
Right.
And then only just make sure the person, the scientists who did this know what they're doing is kind of, you check that eventually, but...
Could you tell me about reading a newspaper?
Sorry, I'm missing your...
Well, I don't know. So what I'm saying is that how much would an editor push back if the story was not, did not have a person leading it off?
Well, I thought it was interesting, and I can bring it in. I didn't bring it with me, but there was an article about the Sloan Digital Sky Survey on the front page of the LA Times. And I'll bring it in. You can take a look at how that starts. Starts off, the first paragraph is, do you know the name of the...
Dan Long.
Dan Long.
I was on the mountain when the journalist was there.
Oh, really?
But the story doesn't... It's interesting. He talked to lots of people, and the story doesn't represent anything to do with how he spent his time and how many people he talked to.
Do you remember how it starts?
Yeah. Well...
It's something about the mountain man just saying
Dan Long has seen more of the universe than anyone but God.
Yeah.
Right? Why does it start off that way? Because putting it in the context of a mythic story. Dan Long has seen, and he has seen more, and that's just the hook, and then it goes into the details. But if the lead of that story, it was the top left corner of the front page, it's like the prime real estate, right? If it were to start off by saying, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey has mapped, more of the sky than any other, telescope, visual light survey of, in history, you're going to read past that?
Well, yeah.
Like, you would, right? But most people won't, where suddenly it's like, okay, I can begin to think this is important because it fits into another, my kind of a story about the universe. So I'm not sure if I answered.
Well, I think that was helpful, because I think the answer is no, that you need to have a person.
Most of the time.
You hinge the origin of the elements on, Burbage, Feller, or Hoyle. You pick one of them and make everybody else a collaborator.
Well, what I'm not saying is, I'm not saying that the scientist, your personal story is the foothold for 99.9% of the world into your science. Because most people have no, astrophysics. What is astrophysics? But if they know even that that Jennifer loves understanding where elements come from, that passion, then people can go, oh yeah, I have passion about, like, I like, I don't know, collecting doilies, you know, and I like knowing where doilies are from, and suddenly they're like, okay, I can relate to you, you know, you have a, you're just your passion is different, yeah.
Just on the same topic,
yeah.
People's perception of science is, I mean, this whole mythical thing is still, is strongly associated with people like Einstein or Galileo. So it's like, he changed things. So if you, this is part of the way that this gets through to the public is, you know, their idea of how science progresses is that individuals make this discovery or do something and progress in this way rather than, you know, this is a big group of people that are incrementally increasing their knowledge.
Mm.
So I think that's, I mean, it just supports what you're saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, but what you're saying is that part of the way that people relate to science is through mythical characters, which then reinforces kind of the problem that we're up against.
Yeah,
expect single warriors to be slicing
exactly.
And
so, yeah.
Whereas, you know, when you become a scientist, you're like, oh.
There was a writer at there was a conference at the end of the Sloan Survey in September, and they put us all on a boat and we went around the Lake of Chicago, and there was a writer who's writing the book of the Sloan Survey.
Mm.
And I think what she was talking about was different. She was talking a lot about the interactions between the people. So she was talking about, you know, a group, quite a large group of people, and how they managed to pull something off. So I think it's possible to write that, but
I think it is, and I think it's finding a new language. I think like the Large Hadron Collider, it's going to be interesting to see the stories that come out of that, because that is so monstrously collaborative, you know? Yeah.
About this person versus the material. Just a couple days ago, a student was having some problems with calculus and asked for help. And the student says, "I hate Isaac Newton." And then, you know, it's a person. You know, he invented this. This is the cause of my problems. And another one, Fermat's last theorem. What's so interesting about Fermat to pretty much everybody is that, you know, how Fermat wrote it, and you know how Antrobal did not do it in collaboratively mostly. And what they made it interesting. What everybody knows is he spent 7 years in isolation in the attic. You know, and that's what people remember about this. This human element. Relationships are not. It's human.
Well, it's heroic, though. And how many of us sort of perceive ourselves? I mean, I think that's the source of discovery, right?
Yeah.
But
the thing with people with which you can identify is that it's hard to describe, whether it's emotion or science or something.
Totally. I mean, you know, when I think the word hero is coming out of a, it doesn't have to mean Homer. You know, hero, the way that I'm talking about, it might be Homer, I'm not saying you're not, you know, but what I'm, you know, Homer of science. Yeah, it means that, you know, it's almost in a, if I can use it, a Jungian sense, right? It's in a psychological sense, it's the actor. There has to be an actor. There has to be the lead, right? I mean, it could be the, you know, the dog that saves the day, you know, in a story like, you know, Lassie or something. But there needs to be.
So it's like a narrator almost.
It's the character. The character. Yeah.
So it's the entry.
Yeah, exactly. You can't have a story without a character, right?
And it's a lot harder to identify with 10 scientists than to identify with one.
That's totally it. Unless you have a much longer. I mean, if you read like James Gleick's book, Chaos, you know, which was a seminal book, it covers, you know, dozens of folks in there. You know, you really get a sense this was a very complex field that was emerging through lots of different thought. But even in a...
But they're also heroes, but I mean, that book.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm not saying they're not here, but just there are more of them. Yeah. More here, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I just want to say a little anecdote that's kind of the opposite of the anecdote that you started with, but it makes the same point.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen this movie, Jimmy Carter, Man from Flames, that just came out recently, it's a documentary, but in one of the scenes in that movie is Jimmy Carter in his church congregation at the front of the church telling them about dark energy. And so that's the kind of work that I do. And that shows you like what can happen if you get it right with getting public outreach right, you know, so that you're getting it out there, and then people are really excited by the awe and the mystery and the whatever. And so it's kind of the opposite of the George Bush and the White House just believing in the church stuff. You're
president
of the church talking about science, right? And so it's, I think that's just a powerful, that's what gets me excited about doing public outreach is when I think about that kind of thing going on that can go on.
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting, I mean, to think about Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth and how that, you know, by changing the whole way that he talked about climate change, you know, turning it into this mass, like kind of a rock opera PowerPoint thing, the impact that had. And I think that, you know, in terms of dark energy, that really is the cosmic story right now, I think, is so amazingly exciting, you know. And I think that for the vast majority of the population, there's very little sense of the kind of revolution that we're in the midst of. Because I often think, what does it feel like to live in a scientific revolution in the midst of it? I don't know. I wonder. I haven't met anybody who who's in these, you know, when the wall came down or when apartheid ended. What did it feel like just before the switch?
Without leading characters in any of the story that we're telling about this science, people can't understand why they should care about the science because it doesn't seem to be affecting human beings. And it's very important for that. That's as an entry point. Very important for them to have some way of saying, even if this guy thinks it's incredibly important because, and then they start.
And I think that, you know, that whole question of meaning is what I realized, you know, with these students who were, you know, I was talking to about evolution, that facts alone are not gonna, there's, what is it, confirmation bias. You know, people will interpret facts to fit the way they view the world. And you have to in some way give them that bridge to a different meaning. You know, so what if, you know, it's dark matter and dark. I mean, what does that mean to me? But when you begin to think that I am really stardust, you know, I am really the result of 13 point, I want to get the numbers wrong here, 13 point, whatever years of, you know, cosmic evolution, then that begins to kind of, that means something, you know?
When I started teaching, I used to tell some stories about scientists screwing up as well, mistakes, and some of my colleagues sort of frowned on me for that, and I asked the kids about it one day, the students, and they said, it makes me feel as if it was possible for me to do that. Mm. You know, so I think that's the other thing. You don't want to be too much of a hero.
No. Well, I really appreciate everyone coming today. I look forward to next week. Thank you.